Set your course for the Huff
Takes Podcast.
Welcome to Huff Takes. I'm Eric Geller.
I'm Grace Seegers.
And I'm Haley Birdwilt.
We're excited to be back with you. And on this episode, we're going to be discussing the second third of Andor Season 1, Episodes 5, 6, 7, and 8. So for those of you keeping track at home, those are the episodes The Axe Forgets, The Eye, Announcement, and Narkeena 5. So we're getting into a period in the show where the stuff that we talked about in our previous episode from the first four episodes of Andor is getting fleshed out. It's getting expanded on. Things are going in deeper directions, in darker new directions. And personally, I'm loving it. But before the show, I asked each of you to think about maybe one sentence that could sum up how you're feeling about Andor at this point when we're more than halfway through this first season. Whoever wants to go first, please take it away. I'd love to know how you're feeling.
I can go first. I would say that I joked beforehand that my sentence would be, it's still really good. That is primarily my sentence. But the perhaps slightly more thought out sentence review would be, to me, it is fulfilling a lot of the potential of Star Wars that as a longtime and long-suffering Star Wars fan, I have felt has been unfulfilled, and to see some of the really cool ideas that Star Wars has previously hinted at fully fleshed out and very well done has been extremely enjoyable and gratifying.
Are we sure that was one sentence?
It was a run-on.
Okay.
She had a paragraph.
That's fine.
Yeah. There were many semicolons.
We love semicolons in this house.
And M-dashes.
Of course. So for me, I agree on like all of those points. And I think so it took me a couple of episodes to like get really into the plot. But like right now, what I'm most impressed by is just how it's been showcasing how there are people who benefit from unjust systems and how it impacts people in like everyday life, not, you know, lower classes. And so, you know, that's what I've really appreciated seeing play out, just like at the Empire like cracking down on people, and even in this most recent episode with Andor in this like prison camp, finding out that like part of these resentencings are from his, you know, his activities, like they used that as the excuse to do this. And so I don't know, I think there's a depth to it that I really appreciate. I think it's impressive.
Yeah, my sentence is similar to both of yours. Not, well, I guess we can call those both sentences. Mine is short and sweet, and it is just, at this point, Andor is amping up the tension, fleshing out multi-dimensional characters, and using Star Wars to really say something. And
man,
going back to
what Eric showing us up with his actual sentence.
Well, you know, I think this is what happens when you take 20 seconds to write out a sentence beforehand because you're a huge nerd, as opposed to just being a normal person who thinks on your feet. But to your point, Haley, this is taking Star Wars to places that we haven't seen before, and, you know, using Andor as a vehicle to tell the kinds of stories that we haven't seen explored. We've certainly seen these themes hinted at in other kinds of Star Wars, right? I mean, the whole prequel trilogy is about the fall of the sort of the constitutional government and the rise of tyranny, but to actually see the real world effects of that on regular people, that is not something that Star Wars has traditionally been focused on or very good at. And so I'm continually amazed by how well they're doing it on Andor. Let's talk a little bit about some of these political themes, some of the ways in which the show is trying to say something about the real world. And I've got some notes in our show notes document, but please feel free to jump in if I miss anything. But there's a bunch of things that we're still grappling with as a society that Andor is taking a moment to try to say, you know, using the sort of the sheen of a Star Wars fictional universe to try to tell us something about these real problems. I have to start with the sort of Patriot Act analogy in the show, which is that after the raid on the Aldani garrison, the ISB gets new powers of, quote, surveillance, search, and seizure. That's a quote from Yularen, I believe. at the ISB meeting. And we see a follow-up conversation actually in this most recent episode, episode 8, with Mon Mothma and her fellow senators, where they're talking about basically, is this good? Is this bad? And one of them says, if you're doing nothing wrong, what is there to fear? And Mon says, well, now I'm fearing your definition of wrong, which I tweeted that out. It's one of my favorite exchanges in the whole show. But what do you think of the way the series is trying to speak to us about some of these themes that, again, are not new to Star Wars, but are being explored in a much more, I think, much more resonant way as we grapple with some of these security issues in our own time?
Yeah, I absolutely love it. I think that good science fiction and fantasy, really good science fiction and fantasy, holds up a mirror to the world that we currently live in and interprets it in a way that is slightly different from the galaxy we are inhabiting, but in a way that is real and can help us make sense of what's going on around us. And like, one of these days I'm going to force someone to sit down as I lecture them for 45 minutes on how the best exploration of the post 9/11 US in the first Bush term is actually Battlestar Galactica, but that is a different subject. But my point is to say that that's my favorite kind of sci-fi and fantasy, is one that holds up that mirror to our society. So all of the political messaging, the issues that we're seeing with surveillance and security state, issues of insurgency, police brutality, the prison industrial complex and forced labor, just every subtle political element that is there, and every overt political element, I am just gobbling it up like handfuls of popcorn, and I'm just really, it's super fun for me.
I want to add to that too, I do appreciate also that there's like a universal element to this, like the kind of evil that they're showcasing. Like people in every country can find, you know, ways that this overlaps with their experiences of government, at least most countries. And especially in this most recent episode, when Cassian was in the prison camp, like there are places on Earth now that are like very similar, except for the floors that kill you. it's the same setup, the same, like you have to work. It is a prison camp. You're there for no reason at all, except existing. And so I appreciate, you know, they are being very clear-eyed about this kind of evil. And so I don't know. I feel like I was reading an article about, I think it was a Disney executive before Rogue One, one of the, like, the people working on Rogue One was talking about white supremacy and how Rogue One is anti-empire, and the empire stands for that kind of thing. And like a Disney executive was like, no, there's no political message at all. And I was just reading that quote earlier, and like this show, there is very obviously a political message. And I think it's very applicable in a lot of unjust, you know, moments and places and time today and, you know, in the past.
I mean, I was sort of sitting there stunned during the scene with the shore trooper when Cassian gets arrested. You know, every moment of that, every little subtlety of it is, I mean, that's how many times have we seen, you know, shaky cell phone footage of that exact thing happening, right? And you strip away the fact that he's wearing the Star Wars armor, the fact that they're surrounded by aliens, that's the real world, right? I mean, this stuff unfortunately does continue to happen. And they carry that through to, you know, the judge sort of sentencing him, you know, barely looking up from her list of convicts. We have all the way through sort of the prison itself and showing how they're kept in chains, you know, metaphorically. They don't have to use literal ones because they pit them against each other. They drain them of basically the will to live, the will to do anything more than just slurp up some nutrients to keep your body functioning while you build something for the war machine. This is, you know, as you said, I mean, this there's this is happening in you know, in the real world to varying degrees in various countries. We can all recognize this both from the past and the present. And I honestly think that there is something to be said for Disney being willing to do this. It's not, you know, I'm reminded of the, I think it was Michael Jordan, right, who said, like, everybody buys my shoes or something like that, basically saying, look, I don't want to step into politics because I have to appeal to a mass market audience. And Disney is, at least with Andor, very conspicuously saying, we're going to leave that behind. And we're actually going to talk about, you know, basically mandatory minimums, right, with this public order resentencing directive, where it's not really about your crime. It's about trying to deter other people from doing what you consider bad things. Right. That's, you know, this is a very...
Disney is the company that thanked a paramilitary organization in Xinjiang for letting them film in the region where genocide is happening for Mulan. And in this show, they are showing you what is happening in Xinjiang. So I don't know. I find it interesting they were willing to do that.
Well, also, I mean, they very famously cut that lesbian kiss out of Rise of Skywalker for the Chinese market. And here we're seeing at least some treatment of a gay relationship, a lesbian relationship, you know, in with Vel and Cinta. And so I guess I don't know how much of this is like they're changing their mind versus like it's a smaller screen. It's different executives making these decisions. I don't know what to make of it. I do think that that contrast is conspicuous, though. And I do think it's worth noting. Yeah, I mean, look, we've talked about politics and politics of Star Wars before. I mean, this is nothing new. All three of us are big fans of the fact that the Star Wars franchise takes on these issues. I think this is the most distilled and overt and but at the same time kind of subtle and careful that it has ever done it. I don't know if you feel the same way, but that's my take.
Yeah, I love the politics of it.
I don't know if it's subtle so much as like just clear. Like there's a clarity to it. And I feel like in the past it may have been like, you know, you want both sides to be able to identify with various parts of, you know, what you're making. And I don't know if that was a big priority for this show. I feel like being very clear-eyed about your priorities and like just the like having a like good writing just really contributes to like making it feel like it's well done in ways that maybe it was not subtle in the past in Star Wars.
Yeah, we all do know how the three of us love politics, and we've all talked about how one of our favorite aspects of the prequels trilogy are the political aspects. And I think for me, this is one example of Andor living up to the potential of Star Wars. Because in the prequels, any politics that we get are really just glimpses, and it's subtle. And if it is there, it's not very well developed. It's occasionally clunky. And here, the politics... I mean, every interaction that Mon Mothma has is politics, and it's just written so beautifully. It's acted so beautifully. And to see just every single element of the way the Empire exerts its control, so not only over the ordinary people of the galaxy, but also over the elite, the people who are having canapes at the cocktail parties, who are saying those things about, well, this makes me feel safer. And, you know, you gotta respect the Emperor for getting things done.
He says what he means, Grace. He says what he means. Did you also really hit on that line and think, who are we talking about here?
The way that it's just being analyzed and applied for the first time, I feel like, in a Star Wars property to actually have the politics of the Empire and of rebellion considered, the political decisions that Luthen is making in deciding that, yeah, this is going to result in people being hurt, but that's rebellion. And the rebellion that he's waging versus the one that Mon's waging versus the glimpse that we get of what Saw is doing. I mean, it's just, again, I'm eating it up. It's so fun to actually see the potential of politics in Star Wars being played out on screen. It's really cool.
And I do want to add some of the writing is just like so apt. Like, I wish Nemec had, like, lived just so that you could have someone to, like, insert those quotes throughout the rest of the series. But I see in our show notes, I think Eric put it in there, but his quote about, you know, the pace of repression outstrips our ability to understand it. It's just so true. And there's so many lines in the show that you think it's like you just feel it. Like, that is an accurate thing. Today, for me, I agree with that. And I think, you know, just having those points just scattered throughout the plot. People, you know, in different stations in life throughout the show saying things that just very much resonate. I don't know. It makes it feel more immediate.
I will just add that specifically that quote, the pace of repression outstrips our ability to understand it. To me, that is a, so this is how democracy dies level quote in terms of it's going to stay with me forever. Like that's just a quote that I feel deep in my
bones.
I would
argue that is, this is how democracy dies updated. For the social media age.
Absolutely. I mean, not just the social media age, but the 2010s and 2020s, I would say, specifically, you know, like the rise of authoritarianism and the idea that we are just inundated with small and large examples of it. And so it can be difficult to know where do you even begin to fight back for democracy. And this is not a new idea, of course. Many people have pointed out that this is actually part of the goal of resurgent authoritarianism is to overwhelm your ability to fight back. But the way that it's expressed here is beautiful.
Love it. Absolutely love it.
So let's talk about our main character, Cassian Andor. We learn more about where he's been and what he's up to in these four episodes. I thought it was really great how, particularly towards the end of the story leading up to the heist, we got a little bit more of a sense of where he's been in terms of he's got this experience. First of all, he's a skilled pilot, right? But also he knows how to walk like a soldier. He's familiar with the night before a big job or the morning before a big job and how to sort of ease your tensions and your nerves. And that's the kind of thing where they don't have to spell it out. You get from that what they want you to get, which is that this guy has been places, he's seen things. There's also some nice subtle moments where he kind of pushes back when Terriman, you know, sort of walks over and sort of claps him on the shoulder and he says, you know, don't touch me. And he sort of tells Skeen, you know, don't touch my bags or whatever. And it's like, this is a guy who's been pushed around all his life. He hasn't felt the security of either his person or his belongings. And he's now, you know, he's able to sort of tell these people to back off. And so he seizes that moment. So I thought that was good kind of exposition showing us where he's been. But I do want to talk about a few moments with him in these episodes that were striking to me, and I want to get your thoughts on them. So let's start with Skeen, right? So Skeen says, we could go in on this money, we could take it, we could leave now. I've got a place where we can lie low. And Cassian just pops him. Were you as surprised as I was to see that?
No, but I feel like part of the suspense of that moment, like I expected him to kill him. But I was also, like, worried because you're like, oh, is he just going to, like, take all of the money and run? Which he did not do. But, I feel like the point of that moment was to see if he was going to do that.
Yeah, the way my fiancé put it in a really interesting way, where even though it's the second time in six episodes that we're seeing him essentially kill someone in cold bloods, somehow it felt like character development, and not in the way that he's still a shoot first, ask questions later kind of guy, but in terms of the motivation behind what he was doing was different, or seemed like it could have been different. And there's this moment, this fraction of a beat after he shoots Skeen, where it's just showing Cassian, and he has this look on his face that can be interpreted in a lot of different ways, but to me it felt kind of like he almost couldn't believe that he had just done that and didn't just take Skeen up on his offer. And as a slight side note, I do think that Diego Luna's facial expressions are incredible. He is just acting the heck out of this part, and the way that he can convey so much with just a look is really phenomenal. But I think it wasn't surprising to me, but it felt different to me than the way that killing the two pre-Mor guards had. It felt like this had a different motivation.
Yeah, I mean, you can definitely read it either as he's going to stop Skeen from betraying the group, or he's kind of, you know, struck by the sense of, well, I'm just in over my head. I got to get out of here. There's things going on that I don't want to be a part of here. I don't want this guy to betray me, so I'm going to kill him, and I'm just going to leave. I'm going to take my part of the money and run away, basically. And I think the fact that it's, I would argue, sort of ambiguous what's going through his mind there adds to the growth of the character, because you're seeing him not, it's not purely like he's going to kill this guard to run away. It's like you're not really sure what's going through his head. He's wrestling with this. And so I do think that that's growth. I think the ambiguity works well in the character. But I do want to touch on another thing you said, Grace, which is that Diego Luna's acting is superb. And you mentioned his facial expressions. Think about the most recent episode as we record this, episode 8, the prison episode. He really doesn't say much. I mean, if you count up the number of lines he has, very few lines. But you always know what he's thinking and feeling by just watching his face. How do you think he played that in episode 8 in terms of getting a sense of his reactions to what was going on around him? Because I thought it was striking just how much he was saying with his performance.
That scene where they're like, he's trying to be added to the assembly. Okay, so I guess it's the whole scene before he even joins, like, that big room where they're like, the guards are on edge and all stressed out.
Yes.
Like, it's all, and when he gets to the table and he's like, he gets the pep talk and like the orders, and then they're like, and then he watches them do it. It's just so disorienting. So I like whatever they did about the production of that. It, like, it feels for the viewer just extraordinarily disorienting. Like, you can imagine coming in your first day and everybody's so on edge because they're like part of this like competition of pain and suffering, right? You have to make as much of whatever that, you know, product is as possible. Even the part where they're like, okay, hands clear, like, I don't know what that's about, but it stresses me out because every time I'm like, someone's hand is going to get stuck and they're going to get injured. Everything about that was just so well done. Like the effect they were going for, they definitely nailed it.
I mean, it doesn't let you catch your breath, which is great because that's what his experience is. And it's not easy to replicate that feeling for somebody who's watching at home,
right,
completely safe from whatever's going on the show. But they figured out a way to do it with pacing and writing and acting, mm-hmm, and editing that you feel some semblance of that, as you said, that sense of disorientation.
Yeah. And when I think about it, I really do think what put the, you know, cherry on top was that scene before he joins it when the guards are like, oh, he's late, and they're like all stressed out. Like, it puts you on edge before he even goes into the room. And like, that was just superbly done.
Yeah. I think the sort of thing that really sticks out to me from that episode in terms of that feeling of disorientation, which, as both of you said, they really nailed. But there are moments in that episode where Cassian really has this expression of someone who's lost but also feeling a sense of disbelief. Like, his face just so clearly reads someone thinking, this can't be happening, this can't be happening, this
yes,
can't be happening. And then the just watching the slow realization that this can't be happening, but it is happening, and I don't know what to do. And the way that he just conveyed that without saying anything, but just watching him and feeling it so viscerally, to just be put in those shoes of being in a scenario where something awful is happening and you think it can't be real, and then it just keeps happening. That just really, I thought that was so well done on his part. And as both of you said, every single element of that whole orientation into the prison was just really well done.
I have one more thing to add about that, the prison camp sequence. I was extremely impressed by the quality of writing at the end when the inmate dies on the, like, in the middle of the night. I like the way that the prisoners react. Like, it, you could just, like, these, like, the people writing the show are just, like, they are just so intentional, because, like, in that moment, they're showing you how oppression can just, like, strip people of their humanity. Like, when all you are worried about is survival, like, when someone dies, you're like, man, that really messes up our, like, quotas for tomorrow. Like, that, like, that's how they reacted, and it, I just thought that was, like, it was very realistic for the setting to have that scene in there.
Yeah, and it's very disturbing, and that only makes us think even more about the system that has, you know, brought them to that point, basically.
Yeah.
Obviously, this is not an easy time for Cassian Andor, and part of that is not just that he's locked up, but that he's separated from the one person he loves more than anyone else, Marva, and she goes through an interesting journey over the course of these, you know, four episodes. There's, of course, the scene that I think is one of the standout scenes of the show, where he tries to get her to leave with him, and she says, basically, no, I'm a rebel. I'm here to see the rebellion succeed. I'm tired of running. And, you, of course, that episode has a couple flashbacks to the death of Clem, Andor's adopted father. But, you know, there's also, I think, an interesting thing that happens in the next episode, episode 8, where you really see her decline after Andor leaves. And, you know, Bix and Brasso, I guess, is the other guy, the guy's name. They talk about how she was found opening up, like, a sewer drain or something, because she thought that that would help the rebels get into the city and defeat the Empire. And it's like, you know, they're talking about, like, finding a home where she can be supervised. That, you know, talk about, like, relatably sad. I mean, this seems like a pretty precipitous decline for her. What are your thoughts on what we see from Marva in these four episodes? I think it has the makings of a potentially tragic story.
So for me, what really stuck out is that scene you're talking about, where Cassian tries to convince her to leave, and she says no, and Cassian says, well, I'll worry about you all the time. And she says, well, that's love. There's nothing you can do about that. And there's just something so pure and so true in that sentiment, and the way that it encapsulates their whole relationship, because they do have a clearly very familial mother-son relationship, but it's also very non-traditional. And to just see that sort of distillation of what love is, especially when you are separated from someone that you love and someone who is in ill health, that was just very powerful. I didn't necessarily get the sense that her mental health was declining, more that it was her physical health.
There's definitely some physical health decline, for sure.
Yeah, I didn't.
I think they showcased the stubbornness of the elderly very well.
Yeah.
Yes. As someone who, we had a hurricane hit my hometown, four years ago, and, like, you know, lots of people evacuated because you were expected to, and they told you to. But many of the people who did not evacuate were older people who, first of all, it's hard to be mobile when you're older, like, you just, but, like, you know, a large part of it was stubbornness. Like, I've been living in Florida for my whole life, and I've never had this problem. What I appreciate about that is, like, as a sane person, you're like, yes, she and Cassian should go leave and, like, live a good life somewhere else. And, like, that plot line plus Cinta and what's her name?
Vel.
Like, both of them are sort of showcasing, like, with a rebellion like this, you don't really get that option. And that's what Cinta was sort of saying in that most recent episode of, like, Vel was like, let's, like, can we stay together longer? Like, what are we doing here? And she was like, no, like, we get what's left behind after we give, you know, everything to the rebellion. And I think, you know, with that Cassian moment where she refuses to leave, I think that, you know, was another way of sort of showing that, like, people are making that decision about, you know, it's not my welfare anymore.
Yeah, I really liked that scene with Vel and Cinta in the most recent episode, because you get so much from their relationship with really a short little snatch of dialogue, and you learn about who both of them are and what they prioritize. But I do think that larger message about sacrifice for the rebellion, it's shown so well in this show, where you see it on the most personal level, what that sacrifice means, whether that means choosing to sacrifice a romantic relationship or choosing to stay behind instead of going with your family member, or the much larger elements of Luthen being willing to incur greater harm to the people that he's trying to help, because that's a level of sacrifice that he believes the rebellion needs. I think it just does a really good job of showing on every single level the cost of rebellion. And again, that cost doesn't exist without the oppression of the Empire. In all of this, the Empire is forcing these decisions by being a horrible repressive empire, and how you fight back against that, there has to be some kind of sacrifice made. And it's really interesting to see on every level and the choices that people make individually and collectively about what's worth sacrificing, both of yourself and of others.
So let's transition from someone who very clearly is not yet sold on the idea of rebellion, which would be Cassian, to someone who is basically making her life all about rebellion, Mon Mothma. We see a lot of fantastic character development and sort of larger political struggle in these four episodes. I want to start with, you know, as you mentioned, Luthen and Mon have this kind of confrontation about what's it going to take to finally start a full-scale rebellion. And she basically accuses him of making things worse with the Aldani raid. And he says, you know what? You've always known it was coming to this, that there was going to have to be reprisal from the Empire that led to further uprising. And you knew innocent people were going to suffer. And so don't come at me with this holier-than-thou stuff. You knew this is where it's going. You just didn't want to admit it. To me, this is sort of it's one of the richest scenes in the show so far, because there's layers, right? On the one hand, I think part of her does know that ultimately something like this was going to be necessary. On the other hand, she's personally revolted by it in a way that I think Luthen has sort of been desensitized to. And then the third layer with her is she's the most at risk of all of them. And so she has the most to lose if this new ratcheting up of sort of rebel activity leads to a crackdown in the political sector. We're already seeing it in other sectors, but if the Empire steps up surveillance of senators known to have perhaps pro-rebel sympathies, she has the most to lose from that kind of escalation. So I love that scene. I love the broader tension between her and Luthen, and just the way that he's not quite a friend, but he's definitely an ally, but they're not exactly seeing eye to eye either. I just think that dynamic is so great. I don't know if you have any thoughts you want to throw in.
I also am really enjoying, again, these political conversations and elements. I think it's really fun to see Mon's home life. Again, slight tangent here. Her outfits are incredible. Every outfit she wears,
they're so good.
They're so good. She looks amazing all the time, which I will say is relevant to this discussion, because it is a kind of armor that she is very deliberately putting on. So I'm not just mentioning her
good
outfits
job,
for totally shallow reasons.
If you didn't, I would have, though.
Yeah, because they're so good. But I think the other interesting thing here, too, is that she clearly comes from wealth and privilege. And that's not to say that her life hasn't been difficult, because, I mean, she's been married since she was 15. Her home life sucks. And she is in a lot of danger. But I think that in a sense, perhaps the stakes of the rebellion weren't quite clear to her as someone who is rich enough to essentially bankroll some insurgency. I don't think she did realize what that would entail to that level. But I love seeing the different forms of how this rebellion is being waged and how that includes, you know, the money element and being the smiling party hosting politician. And I think that the actress Genevieve O'Reilly is just doing a really excellent job with conveying all of that complexity.
While we're here talking about like the dinner parties and stuff, can we discuss like the drink worms?
Yes, we can.
What were those? And did they dissolve in the drink? Because I'm like, I was disturbed.
That's kind of gross. You're right. They did kind of dissolve.
Ew. I don't know. I just wanted more answers on what exactly that was.
I have a feeling that there will be a visual guide entry for those drink worms that you can look up in about a year and a half when they do the visual guide for Andor season one. You'll get all the info you want on the home planet of those worms, how they're actually sentient, surprise surprise. There'll be all kinds of details. Yeah, so let's talk about her home life, because just briefly, because, you know, it continues to be really depressing. She basically has no allies in her own home, which only makes her isolation in the Senate, which we saw in one of these episodes, even sadder, right? In the Senate, she's talking about Gorman, and nobody cares, right? And we're continuing to build to the Gorman massacre here, but nobody listens to her. At home, she's either a joke, you know, to her husband, in terms of her political activities, or she's just kind of annoying to her daughter, right? Lita doesn't, you know, there's a great scene where she's like, you don't have to drive me to school. Like, you don't need those free PR points. Like, everybody gets it. You're the good mom. Just leave me alone. Like, that is just so sad. And we're not used to seeing Mon knocked off balance like that, because she goes toe-to-toe with people in an arena where she's better able to hold her own. But at home, what do you say to that? You know, she's not going to rebuke her daughter the way that she does, you know, Massameda or whatever. Like, she just, it's not the same kind of confrontation. And so I just like that drama and the stress and the strained nature of that home life, because it adds to a sense of, you know, she's pouring everything into her work. And there's a chicken and egg scenario. Maybe if she was not as committed to the rebellion, home life could be different. On the other hand, maybe it's the sad, broken nature of her family life that is inspiring her to try to make the galaxy a better place for others. So there's just so much to pull apart there. And yeah, I mean, I agree. You know, Genevieve O'Reilly is just doing a standout job.
I do think, as we have previously discussed in our Looking Forward to Andor episode, the fact that she got married as a teenager is a lot. It is real weird. I thought that was such a good little scene where both of them are talking about it, and the couple they're talking to is like, oh, how romantic. And then both Mon and Perrin have these little looks like, yeah, so romantic, guys. But I think it's clear that the root of their estrangement comes from that. And I think that their relationship is very interesting in a deeply sad kind of way.
He's such a man child.
Yes.
And they established that so quickly. Like again, one of the instances where the writing is just very good, where he's like, oh, I can't have my fun friends over.
Well, speaking of friends, Mon has an ally now in Tay Kolma, her fellow Chandrillan, seems to be some kind of financier. And I like that she's able to turn to this one person. They have that great moment where, you know, he's like, I think you'd find my politics are a little more extreme than yours. And she's like, oh, ho. And I like that, you know, she starts to tell him a little bit. She obviously doesn't let him in on the full secret, but she gives him enough for him to sense that something's going on that he shouldn't tell other people about. And she then sort of has this kind of moment where she says, smile. And it's this kind of strained, like, okay, you know something now. You got to keep your mask up. And I love that sort of watching her bring somebody else in and then watching her sort of tell him, okay, there are stakes. I just made this very dangerous for you. You're in danger now because of me, and you got to put your shields up just like I do. I love hearing her talk about kind of how the Mon Mothma that everybody knows is an illusion. It's this great insight into how she thinks, how she feels, that we haven't gotten before. And she also has this great moment where she's talking about basically what she's trying to do, and she says, I've learned from Palpatine. I show you the stone in my hand, you miss the knife at your throat. Whoever thought we'd hear Mon Mothma talking like that? I mean, this is so boss. Like, I can't get over how many different, like, levels of Mon Mothma we're seeing, but also how many different faces of her, like different facets of her life. And I love that we're really seeing her step up into this leadership role before she's officially the leader of anything. She recognizes that Palpatine is a dangerous enemy, but she is showing all the hallmarks of someone who knows how to confront him. And, you know, we can't leave talking about Mon Mothma and her family life without just throwing down one little marker that hopefully will pay off before we get to our next episode about the next four episodes of Andor, which is, what's going on with Leeta? Something's going on with this girl. There's a couple shots in this episode where she's just looking real sketch, and I'm just going to say I think she's working for the ISB or some kind of double agent. I think that she's up to no good. I know that I'm not alone in this. Do you share my thoughts on this?
I think she's up to something sketchy. I don't know if she's full-on working for the Empire, but there's something weird going on with her, and I think we're meant to note that there's something weird going on with her. But I haven't gotten to the she's a double agent yet.
Okay, so clearly I have more work to do to convince you, but we don't have time for that in this episode of Hot Takes. Let's talk briefly about Luthen. We see some nice kind of fleshing out of his role here. We met him as kind of the rebel mastermind, but here we see that he's not perfectly calm at all times. He's thinking about Cassian out there, for all he knows, blabbing about who he is, and we know from these episodes that the Empire is hot on his trail, and it knocks him off balance. As his assistant Kleya points out, you know, he's rattled, he's slipping. And I like seeing him in that light, that he's not perfect, that he's capable of having these anxieties as well. But we also get the sense that as much as, you know, Cassian has created this unexpected element that he's having to deal with, he does have this grand plan. He does have this far-reaching vision, which is that the rebels need to unite. And that's when he goes to Saw and really tries to do everything possible to convince Saw to come out of sort of his hermitage, basically, and work with other rebels. And, you know, he knows that's the only way to succeed. And I think it's so cool that we're actually seeing somebody try at this early point to knit these groups together, to show basically that far-reaching vision of we all need to work together because we just can't win if we're doing what Saw Gerrera is doing, which is just fighting alone. So I thought it's great. I love seeing kind of them building new layers to his personality.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that moment in the cave with Saw Gerrera, how Luthen is being like, did you do that thing on Aldani? And they have this sort of thing like, it was really you though. And it's just a very fun way for Luthen clearly putting on his political face, where even though he's trying to get Saw to work with other rebels, clearly he doesn't trust him enough to tell the truth himself. The one other thing I will note here is that I love Luthen's assistant, Kleya. I want to know more about her. What's she up to? Where'd she come from? Because she's clearly up in the know about these rebellious efforts and able to speak with Luthen about them and to Luthen. In a way that is not typical assistant behavior. So I don't know if we'll ever learn anything else about her, but I think she's real neat.
Yeah, he clearly trusts her. I mean, he has her go out to meet Vel, and he trusts her to take precautions and to tell her what she needs to hear. I mean, she's not, as you said, she's not just a clerical assistant. She's very much an intellectual, an ideological ally of his. There's more of an evenness to them than I think we typically see in as you said, those kinds of assistant relationships. So I also want to know more about her. I hope she's not a double agent, because that would be very sad. But with Tony Gilroy, you can never say never. So let's talk about the Empire and some of the characters who are really starting to rise up in the ranks, and also to demonstrate that there is more than one way to write and act an Imperial character, a villain. Dedra Miro, the ISB officer, is one of my favorite characters on the show. And part of that is just she's competent. She's smart. She's not a sneering, backstabbing villain. She's not that cackling, mustache-twirling type of Imperial. And that's what we're used to seeing. But she's actually really good at her job. Not perfect, right? She's a believable person. She has her own sort of self-doubts. And, you know, her assistant at one point has to kind of buck her up and say, like, no, you're onto something. Like, ignore the doubters. But she's one of the few people who can piece together what Luthen is doing, or at least some aspect of it. And interestingly, she also seems to be the only one who can see that the Empire is playing into the Rebellion's hand. So I wonder where that's going to go. That's an interesting story thread that's being dropped in here too, is she recognizes that there's, you gotta do something, but perhaps this is not the best way to go about it. You're only inviting more insurrection at this point. So I'm just fascinated to see where she goes next. And I just think, you know, everything that we've seen of her makes her one of the best villains that we've ever seen in Star Wars, just because she's much more three-dimensional.
And I think, so it's not necessarily an American show, but like, I think a lot of the qualities that we like in her are very like, the qualities that Americans are like, brought up to like. It's like, she's a self-starter. She, you know, does it and then asks forgiveness later. Like, she can, she's, you know, she's has some ingenuity, like, but it showcases like how people can use those things that we like typically really appreciate in a person for like a cause that is like evil. So I don't know, I think, you know, the audience watching it might feel torn, especially the American audience, like, oh, we love watching her do battle in this, like, you know, the room where they have their meeting, their 9 a.m. Monday meetings. But she's like obviously going after the good guys. And I think the moral complexity of the show is also just like, maybe I would have to see like more of the show to like make this a definitive statement, but it might be the best in all of Star Wars, but I would have to see more for the reason that like you have those like conflicting views of people. Because even like watching the Luthen stuff and watching the prison camp scene where they're telling him like the reason we are in here indefinitely is because of you, like it really does like ask the reader, the viewer, to like ask those questions and think about like how far is too far, and you know what, who is morally right in this situation. I don't know. I think it's very complex for a Star Wars show.
I would definitely agree with that assessment, with the caveat that we will have to see the full show. But I think if it continues going the way it's going, then that, I would say it is definitely the most, or up there among the most morally complex Star Wars outputs. With regards to Dedra, however you say her name, she kind of reminds me of Thrawn in that she's this really smart villain that you're almost rooting for. Like, you want to see her destroy her coworker in the meeting. You want to see her rise through the ranks. But then you remember, like Haley said, oh, wait, no, she's a bad guy. But then, of course, there's the questions of what is and isn't a bad guy. And I think we're all firmly on the side of the Empire is bad. And Star Wars has established that pretty well. But I think that making her a villain that you still want to see more of and are almost rooting for in a way was a very smart choice.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a difference between making you wonder if the Imperial is good or if there's a reason to root for them, and making you realize that even bad people are people, right? And that isn't to say that you would sympathize with or justify what they do, but just to recognize that, like, even the worst people, like, have families, have ambitions. Like, that's just a fact of human existence. And so acknowledging that and seeing it is much more interesting. It's more compelling to see a person who isn't one-dimensional, even if they're a bad person. It doesn't mean you have to buy into what they're doing. It means that there's just a richness and complexity that just raises the bar overall of the nuance of whatever you're watching, right? If the good guys aren't the only ones who have complexity, that's just a better product. It doesn't mean that you're liking the bad guys. It just means that there's more depth to them. And I think that's really, that's done very well with Dedra. I also think it's done well with Cyril. I will say Cyril has come a long way in my estimation from those first few episodes. You know, he starts off as kind of a caricature of an overly proud kind of corporate security bureaucrat. But I think there's room to say that at this point he's starting to become more than that. And again, it comes down to you don't have to like him or sympathize with his goals, but you do have to recognize that this is a person who is genuinely motivated by something that is not selfish, and he's doing everything possible to try to accomplish this goal. You know, I love sort of seeing him meet Dedra. I'm still not totally sure why she doesn't want him to help her out. It seems like she recognizes the urgency of finding Luthen, so why not bring in a guy who's like at least heard his voice, as Cyril says. You know, Cyril just gets a lot of development in these four episodes, both with his mom, and, you know, the scenes with his mom are just hilarious. But there's also depth to it in terms of a mother looking out for her son. And then there's the Bureau of Standards, which is this great kind of Orwellian, almost parody. It's not quite that comedic, but there's elements of it that are sort of absurdist. And then it's, you know, well, now he's still in the Bureau of Standards doing everything he can to try to find Cassian. I don't know. I think it's great. I think going back to what you were talking about, Haley, where it's like you have to step back and realize, oh, no, these are the bad guys. Like, he has that great line where he says, can one ever be too aggressive in preserving order? And he's really trying to get Dedra to work with him, to extend a hand. And you're rooting for him to prevail on her and to convince her. And then you realize, oh, that's like one of the most fascist things that anybody's ever said in the show. But it's it's delivered in a way where you're like, I get it. Like, he's not the mustache twirling, like, we must kill everybody so that we can rule. Like, this comment is coming from a believable place, a place where you can understand why he feels this way. You don't have to sympathize with it, and I don't, but it's important to be able to understand why he feels that way. That is the mark of good character development, and they pull that off spectacularly.
I think he's a really good example of someone who has had their foundational beliefs about themselves and about the world shaken. And when you face that kind of internal reckoning, you can either sort of reevaluate or you can double down. And he definitely doubled down. And I think that's just such a realistic thing of what people do when faced with a sort of a flicker of doubt or of this idea that what you thought you were working for may not be good. And in trying to do your job, you got people hurt. And instead of taking a beat to think about his role in everything that happened on Ferrix, instead he goes to ground, decides to clear his name, and is further emboldened in his mission. And that's very human. That's something that people do a lot of the times when they're faced with a difficult situation and a potential reckoning. Instead of taking that route, they choose to continue along the path that they are on, but follow it down even more extreme pathways. And so I really like how they're examining how a man like this can be radicalized, and in a way that is very realistic, and again, something that we see echoes of in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of, you know, the Imperials, I do just want to touch on very briefly, one of the things Andor does really well is actually show you what Imperial oppression looks like to regular people, and not just what it looks like, but how it affects them. You know, in shows like Star Wars Rebels, we have our heroes who are fighting against the oppression, and they talk about the oppression, but we don't really linger on how the oppression affects regular people and where it comes from. And particularly that last Aldani episode, The Eye, does a great job of showing the relationship between the Imperials and this native population, the Donnies, and how the Empire kind of disdains them. They mock them. They mock their smell. And the Donnies are just kind of doing their thing as best as they can, looking for ways to kind of needle the Empire, you know, without provoking them too much. I put in the notes, you know, the fact that they are persisting in their traditions is a form of resistance. It's a way of standing up. And certainly we see this in the real world all the time, including with subjugated native populations. And so I just think it's so textured and nuanced how we are seeing this happen. You know, there's things like the TIE fighter that flies really low over the valley, and all the rebels have to sort of duck because maybe it'll sort of fly too close or something. And it's like this very evocative metaphor of like, we can push you around and remind you of who's boss. And as Cassian says, they're so fat and comfortable, you know, they don't even worry about somebody pushing back to a large degree, right? Pushing back maybe with some kind of snide comment like the Donnie leader does, but not pushing back in any really significant way. And they're so confident of that, that they can do those kind of cruel things. I just thought it was really well done, especially in that episode, how they deal with native populations at this moment where they don't quite, they can't go full fascist yet. They still have to sort of lease the land, but as that
and
imperial,
do the fur trade every year.
They do the fur trade, but the Commandant points out that's going to go away soon. And I think what's great in the show is we're starting to see it's tipping toward the eventual kind of, okay, no holds barred, right? Like now everybody's free to do whatever they want to oppress people. Like the Senate still exists, but like, you know, I think Yularen is the one who said, like, the Emperor is going to be submitting a package of legislation to the Senate to give more powers or whatever. And it's like, you know that that's going to get rubber stamped because you can tell at this point the Senate exists, but it's not doing much. It could create fact-finding commissions, you know, much like the Republic and the Phantom Menace, but it doesn't have any real power. And so I love where this is situated in terms of how the oppression's happening and how it's being done in careful ways because they still have to be careful about it, but pretty soon they're not going to have to be careful anymore. And I like that we're getting to see them right tiptoeing right up to the edge of that. So I just wanted to make that point. I think it's really well done.
I also think they're doing a really good job of showing that on Ferrix too, and seeing how it basically the Imperial presence grafted onto the pre-existing Primor presence and then sort of subsumed Primor and then ramped up the sort of security state elements. So it's kind of gradual, it's creeping, but then they're in a full-on occupancy and it's this new reality that the people have to adjust to. And I think that's also very well done.
All right, before we wrap up, I just want to run through a few brief tidbits. I mean, there's just so much. We can't pack it all in to 1-hour-long episode, but I got to just mention briefly how great the acting is, particularly supporting players like Fiona Shaw and Ben Miles, who plays Tay Colma, just doing fantastic jobs. Obviously, the main cast continues to be extraordinary. All of them are doing such great work. I think that the acting is absolutely one of the strongest points of the show, and I'm just so glad, you know, from Diego Luna on down, they're just nailing it in terms of performances. A couple character things. Cool to see Yularen. That's a nice sort of cameo, but like, you know, Saw himself, you know, a cameo that makes sense. I'm glad that we're sort of starting to see more elements of sort of the traditional Imperial iconography, which they held off on for a while. So we, in these 4 episodes, we see our first stormtroopers, our first, you know, close-ups of TIE fighter pilots. And so they're opening up the aperture a little bit of familiar Star Wars, but they're not overwhelming us with it. We do see a KX droid, like, you know, K2SO type droid, but definitely not K2SO, definitely not Cassian's friend. He was kind of an integral part of that whole, like, police brutality scene. I thought that was really well handled. There's a bunch of references in these episodes to factions out there that are opposing the Empire that I can't wait to hear more about. Saw mentions a few of them, Mon mentions a few of them. I really hope that we get some more exposition on what are these groups doing, what sets them apart from each other. Hopefully, maybe the end of the season is some kind of convening of Mon and other people and perhaps representatives from those groups, and we get to get a little bit more of a sense of what's going on with them, because I think that would add a lot. I think that would be really cool. We see clone troopers in the Clem flashback. That was certainly very sad to sort of think of them as the bad guys at this point. What else? Oh, so in the prison, we meet Melshi. Melshi was one of the Rebel Strike Team members from Rogue One. I think it's kind of interesting that they're showing us this is how Cassian met him. And again, like Saw, like Yularen, it's a cameo that makes sense. It's organic. It fits right in. If you don't know who he is, you're not going to lose anything. But if you do know who he is, this is a nice little moment to kind of build out the story of Cassian's life. I don't know if there's any other things you want to mention before we go, but, you know, we definitely could not get to everything in this episode.
The only other things I will note is that you all know it's been well established how I love pointing out when actors are in other things. So Skeen, he was in The Bear. We just finished The Bear. It's very
good.
That
is true. And he's like the same character.
You should watch The Bear.
The Bear is so good. Everybody should watch it. It's funny because I started The Bear right before watching him in his episode, in his first episode here. And it was definitely one of those moments where, oh, okay, kind of the same guy a little bit. Like, he never gets to play a nice guy.
Yeah, it was very much the same character. Okay, to be fair, though, I only watched one episode of The Bear thus far.
It's very good. You should keep going. The other person, actor that I went a little over was Andy Serkis,
yes,
who played the kind of prisoner foreman who, I mean, most famously played Gollum, but, you know, has just been in a whole host of things and is a wonderful action in live action or motion capture. Second thing I will note really quick, it's freaking beautiful. The sets are so well done. Everything feels lived in. The Eye episode, the sky was just gorgeous and so well done. And then final note, I convinced my mother to watch this show, and my mom does not like Star Wars. And she has tried over the years to watch Star Wars, despite me telling her she really doesn't have to. But she even listens to this show for some reason. So hi, Mom. But she loves Andor. So I think that also really speaks to the way that this show is able to connect to even non-Star Wars fans.
I want to visit the beach planet, Space Florida. I want to go there. It looks so beautiful.
Okay, I loved seeing that aspect of, like, she was asking for, like, some candy or, like, liquor or something. I don't know. I think it was just sort of fun to see something like that in Star Wars. She's like, go to the store.
That was such a funny scene, like, because it makes you wonder, how long have they been there? Like, how much time has passed that they're already, like, making grocery lists? I think before we wrap up, the one other thing I want to say is, it continues to do a really good job of hitting those relatable notes, right? There's just a lot of, they spend time in, whether it's like Dedra, you know, putting on her uniform, getting ready for the day, or like seeing the subway station, or, you know, the ISB guy who's like, tell your families you're going to be working the night. One of the reasons I think it's so successful for, as you said, Grace, normal people, not Star Wars nerds, is that they take the time to infuse it with these relatable bits, these snippets of everyday life that allows you to relate more to these people when they're doing very not normal things. And so I have to shout that out before we go, because I think it's one of the biggest reasons that this is successful, is that they find a way to build in those moments without making it feel like, now we're going to do the relatable moment. It's just woven in so nicely. So I have to shout that out before we go. All right, that's going to do it for this episode of Hoth Takes. Thank you so much for joining us. If you want to share your thoughts about our show or suggest topics for future episodes of Hoth Takes, you can email us at hothtakes@gmail.com, or you can find us on Twitter at Hoth Takes. I'm Eric Geller on Twitter. Grace is Grace_Seegers, and Haley is Burdenator. Speaking of Haley, she made our wonderful logo and banner art. I edited this episode, and I also put together our music, although for legal purposes, we want to point out, as always, that all Star Wars themes and sound effects are the intellectual property of Lucasfilm. You can find a complete archive of past Hoth Takes episodes on our website, hothtakes.wordpress.com, and if you're enjoying our show, please do share it with a friend. You can find Hoth Takes on all the major podcasting platforms. That includes Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. We will see you next week. May the Force be with you.